Edwards Wildman has an active technology and communications regulatory and transactional practice, in which Larry is a member of the Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Division and leads the firm's cloud computing group. Larry previously served as president and CEO of WorldNet Telecommunications. Please welcome Larry Friedman to Cloud Computing East.
Good morning, and thank you so much. It's a little bit intimidating to come on after companies like Amazon and Google and companies like that. Now, I suppose I could brag that our law firm has actually been around longer than any of those companies. I suppose I could say we've been around longer than all those companies combined, but in a technology arena, I'm not sure that's a good thing. So I'll leave that to go. The other thing that I thought was interesting was the concept of what is cloud and the confusion. And a couple weeks ago, the Washington Post here in town did one of their Sunday Outlook Five Myths of on Cloud Computing. And they were talking about an interview that they did in a study asking consumers, what does it mean, cloud computing? And 51% of them were wondering whether it worked when it rained or not. So clearly, we have an industry challenge. But I'm here today and going to try and stay pretty faithful to the topic that I was asked to cover, which are these regulatory frameworks and pending legislation affecting the G-Cloud and H-Cloud sectors. And so after some introductory points, I'm going to really touch on four things. I'm going to talk about issues for all cloud providers. I'm going to talk about the G-Cloud or government cloud sector. I'm going to talk about the H-Cloud sector. And then finally, I'm going to talk about pending legislation. I think the highlight is really this. Regulatory issues are among the paramount impediments to the continued successful deployment of cloud solutions in these sectors. So it's not about figuring out the technology, and it's not about developing the software. Of course, more can be done in those areas, but we've sort of figured a lot of that out. The fiber networks are there. It's really about, and data bears this out, there was a survey in the as to what the biggest impeding factor in cloud in the healthcare environment was. And 51% of those answering the survey said data security and privacy was the biggest impeding factor. In the government arena, and when talking to sort of officials from federal agencies, when they were asked to point to the primary barrier to the increased deployment of cloud computing, 73% said it was data privacy and security issues. So these are the big challenges that I think the industry wants to focus on. I think the headlines in terms of the top issues are the following. There are general issues, and then the sort of law has taken what I would call a very sort of sector-by-sector approach. So each sector kind of has its own unique rules and history associated with that. Among those top issues are data breach notification laws, which we'll talk about a little bit, data security laws, which we'll talk about a little bit, and one I know that's near and dear to the organization and top of mind is ECPA, or the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and some of the reforms associated with that. So let me first talk about issues for all cloud providers. I think data privacy and security is a headline issue, and it's understandable and intuitive that for any customer, whether they're a sophisticated government agency or a consumer business or anyone in between, that whatever concerns you may have had about the privacy and security of your data, they're exacerbated when it's not right under your fingertips. The CEO, or let's say former CEO of Target, will probably attest to how important that can be, given their well-publicized data breach and what ultimately cost him the loss of his job. Data privacy and data breaches are very fragmented right now in terms of what the law is generally in the United States and in the world. So for starters, we've got a much different regime in Europe than we have in the United States. Generally, it's stricter and tougher in Europe. That has led to some major disconnects about how companies can comply. And I think an overarching global challenge that we find as the lawyers wanting to kind of guide clients to a successful solution in this area is to harmonize how to comply with these conflicting requirements. By the way, shameless plug for our firm's data privacy and security group, we just finished an annual white paper where we collect up all of the rules of the road. And as a courtesy for Marty and the group, we would make that available. If you give me your card afterward and you're interested in getting a complete rundown of what's going on, not only in the United States, but in the world, we're happy to provide that to you. It's over 100 pages. So internationally, that sort of challenge is one. And there was in the newspaper just 2 days ago a ruling by way of example that showed how much more important privacy is in Europe, that said that Google was required to take down links for anything that had personal private information about an individual. An extraordinary ruling that will cost Google many millions of dollars and just signifies the disparate treatment of privacy and security issues in Europe compared to here. Here in the United States, out of 50 jurisdictions, we have, I tried to figure out how this could be, 51 different rules. So I mean, I guess that's because there's four territories. So we literally have a hodgepodge of different state laws in the United States that govern data privacy and security. California and Massachusetts are out front on a lot of this. Massachusetts rule, which is one of the strictest, is often called the gold standard. One of the challenges for a cloud provider is to kind of right size a compliance regime that keeps you safe and on the good side of compliance on the one hand, while on the other hand not costing a fortune or creating such a cumbersome set of policies and procedures as to impede your ability to win. And technical data privacy and security is part of it, so having the technical solutions in place is key. Having policies and procedures and employee instructions and protocols that would drive the company, in short, that when the regulator knocks on your door, whether you're the president of Target or anyone else, and says, how did this happen, you have something more to show them as to what you were doing to protect them than just high hopes. One of the things that is pending in Congress right now are proposals from both Congress and the White House for a federal data breach notification law that would preempt state laws. Almost irregardless of how you may feel about the details, I would think that perhaps everyone in this room who's looking to deploy cloud or consume cloud services would be interested in this and generally favor this. Maybe we'll actually get bipartisan support for something in the United States Congress, because it would solve this huge challenge of this fragmented state-by-state system. So that's one of the headlines for pending legislation. In overall issues, of course, ECPA and hacktivism and Snowden spying are issues that are top of mind. In the time I have, and I will try to stick to the schedule, I won't go into all the details other than to say that there is a federal law that dictates the government's right to grab information from that is either stored or in transit with a telecom company, depending on how long it's been there. And so 180 days has traditionally been the touchstone. Less than 180 days, it's considered transitory and therefore a higher burden to kind of get a communication, just like you couldn't typically grab a letter when it was at the post office. More than 180 days is considered something along the lines of storage and a lower burden to kind of grab that. Congress is looking to kind of reform and harmonize those laws. Cyber espionage is of great interest and a common issue for cloud companies. And this isn't just Edward Snowden type ideological espionage, but private cyber espionage. Estimates of $14 billion in economic losses during the most recent 6 month period based on that sort of private espionage. So that highlights the need for technical and administrative measures. Let me focus now on G-Cloud, the government. I think the headline here in terms of what the government is trying to do from a quasi-regulatory perspective is FedRAMP. And FedRAMP was mentioned by a couple of the speakers earlier, and I'll touch briefly on what that means. First of all, let me explain the acronym. So it's called the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program. And really what that is the government's way to begin to kind of socialize and make some sense out of a very huge disparate effort to weave in certifications and qualifications for cloud providers for all the different potential kinds of uses and applications that could theoretically be deployed as a cloud provider to the United States government. There are specific rules and regulations. Again, we have details on this. I'm not going to go through all those in the brief time I have this morning, but again, if anybody is interested in getting a primer on FedRAMP, if you give me your card at the end, I'll be happy to send that information to you. Generally speaking, I'll just highlight some of the top ones. It's a gateway to being qualified to provide services. Federal agencies have 2 years, once FedRAMP is operational, to ensure that all of their cloud deployments meet FedRAMP requirements. FedRAMP is part and parcel through something called the Federal Cloud Computing Initiative. That, again, is a cross-agency project of the United States government to, again, harmonize and socialize the way cloud is deployed across government lines. Notably, the GSA has a cloud-first policy that, in essence, mandates that cloud be considered as at least a first option for deploying to the government. We tried to do a sort of latest and greatest on FedRAMP. From the information we have, which may or may not be accurate, only 16 authorized and provisionally authorized cloud systems thus far, so it's a small number and a very slow and measured deployment for various reasons. On April 22nd, just a few weeks ago, the GSA released a transition plan to update some of the security control baseline and documentation templates that are the part and parcel of FedRAMP. Those are expected to be published around June 1st of this year. And finally, government agencies and cloud service providers have until June 5th to show that they meet current baseline controls. So FedRAMP is very important if you're either in the consumption or provision of cloud services to the federal government, and provides one of the most government-specific regulatory requirements to be aware of. Switching gears to the H-Cloud arena, obviously, or perhaps not so obviously if you're not in that area, the headline news there is what are called HIPAA or high-tech, the specific rules that have been around for some time dictating the various sorts of requirements applicable to generally keeping medical data, which, of course, every company thinks all their data is safe, but each of us probably particularly considers that personal information about your medical condition is particularly important, and that's been recognized through some of the legislation and regulations passed in the healthcare sector. There are a couple things just to note in terms of highlights on what is going on in regulation in the healthcare arena. First of all, there has been an incentive and indeed a requirement to move medical information, in effect, to the cloud. Medicare and Medicaid, what are called EHR, which are electronic health record incentive programs, provide financial incentives for something called, quote, meaningful use, close quote, of certified EHR technology. The old Stimulus Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, authorized incentives for physicians and hospital providers to kind of do this. Headline news was an expansion of the coverage of some of the HIPAA and high-tech requirements to include cloud providers. So for a number of years, the cloud companies were sort of basking in the glow of a free pass under the way that those laws were identified in terms of which companies were a business associate and which ones had the legal obligations to have that updated standard of protection that attached to medical records. Somewhat recently, within the last year or so, the high-tech law, which is the federal law governing this, has changed and expressly closed what you might have considered a loophole or free pass, and now embraces cloud providers within that covered arrangement. So you need something called a business associate agreement as a result if you're using the cloud. That's something we've worked on. That's something that major companies like Google and Microsoft and others are now starting to offer and roll out. In the few minutes I have left, very briefly, I'm going to hit on some pending legislation and just a few quick headline news items. As I mentioned, there are numerous federal bills impacting this area. One of the big ones that's out there is data breach notification proposals. So there are several of those. Those are basically laws that are trying to harmonize, again, these disparate state requirements about what is required in the event of a data breach, what kinds of notifications have to be provided, and to whom they have to be provided. And in the interest of time, I won't go through, but there are two or three bills from senators and various people in Congress that have addressed that issue. There's an issue about big data, and the White House has released a policy recommendation focusing on big data, which again is designed to harmonize some of the cybersecurity standards associated with that. ECPA reform, which has to do with the latest bulk surveillance, is of great interest. And President Obama and now Congress have sort of taken that up within the last month or two to kind of ease people's concerns that the government is collecting all of our electronic communication and trying to shift that a bit by leaving that collection in the hands of the phone companies or the telecom providers. The government can still have the right to get to it, but they have to meet, in essence, a showing to this particularized court that they need it before they can get it. You could argue, by the way, as to whether that really makes a difference in your comfort level about the government access to your data, but that is sort of the way things have gone. Lots of other stuff going on in the feds. It's a very active space. I'm just going to conclude with a couple quick highlight notes. Literally today, the Federal Communications Commission is considering something called net neutrality. It is a blazing red hot issue, a completely misunderstood and misportrayed issue, in my opinion, in so many ways in terms of what it is and what it isn't. I'm just going to do two quick things, which is sort of summarize what the issue is and relate to how it impacts cloud. Net neutrality, the concept would be that it would prohibit any sort of blocking or discrimination or preference by a telecom network operator, their traffic versus others, any traffic. This regulation was passed back in 09, 010, thrown out by the courts, passed again, thrown out by the courts again, and now the FCC is in the process, a several-month process culminating in literally a meeting today to figure out if they can come up with new rules that will meet the court standards. Some of the legal issues are what we call inside baseball, what sort of legislative authority that the FCC is relying on. But the core of it also really relates to what is a regulated or what is a non-regulated service. And the interesting thing is for decades, the FCC has issued seminal rulings that basically have created a bright line between regulated common carrier telephony voice service versus broadband. And telephony common carrier service is regulated and broadband is not. And by imposing requirements on broadband network operators, they're crashing through that bright line in a way that has created a lot of angst. The cloud industry ought to be concerned about this, particularly cloud providers who have relationships with network providers, because one of the issues, data privacy and security, is convincing valuable customers or potential customers that their mission-critical data will be available upon demand. And those customers may say that if it's a choice between my critical corporate mission-critical information or somebody downloading, you know, their favorite, you know, comedy movie or something worse in the middle of the night, and there's a choice that I should, for a fee, be able to pay for the excess capacity that my network might require in order to prioritize that data. I think this hugely impacts the cloud industry. I actually don't think that issue has been as well explained or understood as it could be. I'm happy to talk offline with you about this. It's an issue we follow quite closely and have a great interest in. There will be more news today, and there will be a ruling today from the FCC, or at least a decision of some sort or another. Of course, the government never finally decides things. So what will happen today is something called a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is the FCC's determination that here's what we think, subject to everybody screaming about it, and then ultimately figuring out what they'll actually do. Two more quick comments. One last quick comment. There was something called the Aereo case, which some of you may have heard of. And my son Ross, who's associated with DCIA, and one of my law colleagues wrote an article, a short article, called "The Supreme Court Decided a Copyright Case, Paren," and talked about cloud computing. And it was fascinating. And if you read the transcript of the oral argument, these Supreme Court justices, some of whom, between you and me, I think, again, they would probably be in the 51% who wonders if cloud works if it rains, have no freaking clue, but they know it's really important because they've gotten these amicus briefs that show the gazillion-dollar impact on the economy that cloud has. And so they got really wrapped around the axle. my sort of quick editorial, which I'm not supposed to do with these things, but what the heck, why not, is that it was a complete red herring, and I'm in the crowd, and I'm in the cheerleader section for cloud. So be it far from me to want any legal case to kind of impact that. But this is truly a copyright case that the broadcasters and the cable companies and the programmers ought to be concerned about and were concerned about. I do not think that the future of the Republic or the cloud computing industry will rise or fall in the Aereo case. That case will be decided by the Supreme Court in June. And unlike the FCC and some of the other federal stuff, that will be a final and conclusive decision. Happy to take questions, and if you want anything from me afterwards, feel free to come by. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. And we'll be able to talk with Larry more during lunch. Our next speaker, Kaiser Wahab, is a partner at Wahab and Medenica, where he serves as a corporate business attorney who recognizes his value is dependent on not only being able to advise, but also to innovate. He's represented Fortune 500 to startup clients on the range of corporate transactional issues, confronting businesses that compete in technology, media, brand, and intellectual property-driven environments. Beginning his career with Pryor, Cashman, Sherman, and Flynn, he later joined Day Pitney, where he handled licensing, trademark, and copyright, and contractual issues for companies like Microsoft and UTC. Please welcome Kaiser Wahab to Cloud Computing East.
I had no idea he was going to read my bio, which is an incredibly shaming thing to hear read aloud to you. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I'm going to start with the fact that my firm is 10 years old, which I think is fantastic because apparently that makes me nimble and a disruptor. I like to say those things. I represent primarily health cloud providers in the EHR realm. So what I'm doing is I'm not representing the governments. I'm representing the developers and the solution providers who are deploying essentially solutions for hospitals and hospital healthcare networks. So I have a different perspective on things. However, I am a cheerleader for cloud as well because these people are essentially changing the environment as we know it. The good news is this, I'm kind of pinch hitting for somebody, a colleague of mine who was originally supposed to do this talk. And unfortunately, I didn't get to coordinate with Larry, so I'm going to rely on luck, which is something that lawyers are never supposed to do, by saying that essentially because we did not coordinate, a lot of what I'm going to talk about is redundant, but in a way that I think is good. I'm going to talk about some of the core statutes that I believe impact both G-Cloud and H-Cloud deployments. I'll drill down into them a little more deeply, and then I'll tell you, I think, some bread and butter considerations to the extent that you are either on the procurement side or on the solution side as to what you ought to be looking to do in some of the most basic transactional arrangements that involve these solutions, okay? So that said, I think I'll start with this. Everyone knows the benefits of cloud at this point, and I think that despite the fact people are concerned about whether or not it works on a rainy day or a sunshiny day, I think they understand, wow, I can get my mail on any device. I can get my mail in any time zone. That's fantastic. And I think, generally speaking, from a solution perspective, everyone understands the value proposition. It's cheaper. It's scalable. It's dynamic. It allows infrastructure to be ported off-site. It allows for remote diagnostics. All these fantastic buzzwords that we love to swim in and we enjoy it and it's great. But I think from the law's perspective, it becomes a far more difficult thing to comprehend. And I'm going to use what I think is a great analogy because typically speaking, when the law tries to grapple with technology concepts, especially post-internet, it's hilarious what they come up with. Some of the cases that involve internet dating, if you're bored, read some of the early decisions revolving around internet dating and the courts trying to struggle with the notion of, wait, let me get this straight. I can get a spouse online? How does that work? And similarly speaking, I think the law is having a difficult time with trying to grapple with what does cloud mean. And I think one of the earlier keynote speakers said, well, who in the room would define cloud as the same thing? But I found one definition by the Florida State Bar, which I thought was relatively workable for purposes of the law, and that's essentially to say that cloud is analogous to essentially getting your well water, not from your own well, but from elsewhere. Someone else is getting your water on a distributed network somewhere else. It's not on your property anymore. And why is that important? Well, not only do I think that privacy is a major concern, which it is, there are a variety of other concerns that come into play: jurisdictional, regulatory, obviously, oversight, control, compliance, implementation, termination. So basically, jurisdictional, the idea of the water being in different places in different times is a novel and lovely concept when you're talking about cost control and availability. But who controls that? Who owns it? What happens if suddenly there are different legal frameworks that are involved? Larry mentioned the EU privacy framework. You know, the EU is obviously a serious concern to the extent that any of this data is going offshore. But similarly speaking, what about, you know, our nation of states, right? Each state has its own jurisdictional framework. Regulatory, we talked about in great detail. Oversight, who is controlling this stuff? How do you control them, and how do you, as either a government agency or healthcare provider, impose the statutory constraints that are imposed upon you upon them? Compliance, how do you assure that these people are doing what they're supposed to do, not only on an ongoing basis, but the word breach was mentioned a great deal relating back to privacy. What happens when breaches occur? Do they have the same obligations as providers that you do to your constituencies? So let's talk about the basic laws involved. You know, there's a constellation. You know, it really is like trying to figure out where the Big Dipper is and where Ursa Minor is. It's just, let's figure this out. And I think everybody has different constellational matrices. In my opinion, the two laws that I'm going to talk to you about are very important. There are many others. Larry mentioned ECPA, PCI, FOIA, Patriot Act. I mean, there are a million others. They're the state breach laws. They're the state analogs to the laws I'm about to talk to you about. No way I can go over them. FISMA is the first one, and I love the sound of it. It sounds like something out of Harry Potter. Federal Information Security Management Act of 2002. Very forward-looking law in concept, passed over a decade ago. The idea was that the government agencies, federal government agencies, had to grow up, and they had to essentially create IT and security frameworks with personnel, with compliance, with oversight, reporting, and essentially take it seriously as if they were corporate tenants, right? HIPAA. Everyone is in this room is likely familiar with the concept of HIPAA as an overarching term, right? Essentially, this is the federal law that controls the use, dissemination, and harvesting of medical data. Medical data is typically referred to statutorily as PHI. We'll talk about it some more. And I'm going to go through essentially the historical frameworks for these as quickly as I can, and then see if I can drill down to how this impacts you. So HIPAA in a heartbeat, enacted in 96, two major components: security, privacy. Kind of a dumb moment, right? Security, privacy seems to make sense. Applies to covered entities. I believe in the early goings there was a lot of discussion about who was a covered entity, but intuitively a covered entity is any hospital, any insurance carrier, any clearinghouse for medical data that's storing medical data. Those are the core covered entities in a nutshell. There are others as well. But then there are these business associates. And then why does that matter to the cloud? Well, because the law has been updated to essentially reflect the fact that cloud service providers, or CSPs, are likely business associates. And as a business associate, they have the same obligations for security and privacy in the medical context as your hospital does. And that's important both on the procurement and the solution side, because it's a very rare argument that will be won for someone in the cloud sector to say, oh, well, that doesn't apply to me. Move on. Nothing to see here. Highly unlikely. Privacy. Essentially, the idea is to protect personally identifiable health information, or PHI as it's often referred to. The idea is that there has to be controls, standards, implementation, oversight, monitoring as to how this data gets from point A to point B. It is not as simple as thumb drives. It is kind of amazing that Snowden happened. It's kind of amazing that all of these things happen. WikiLeaks was a function of someone bringing in a CD, you know, and everyone thought it was just his music. Who listens to music on a CD player? They just thought it was his MP3 player, and they essentially missed the fact that he copied all of that data onto a burnable CD. That's what the law is trying to avoid by having controls. So the security rule essentially says, well, in order to promote privacy, we have to have security. And what we need to do, we being the healthcare community, is we have to have administrative and technical safeguards. Administrative would be as simple as, well, look, you know, a password that says, you know, God1234 is probably not going to fly. It's going to have to be a structured password with you know, a dynamic rollout and dynamic changing. It has to be something significant. Similarly, there might be technological implementations to prevent the dissemination of PHI in a way that people were not expecting. So what is PHI? This is important for you to understand. The way I look at it is it's every single reasonable identifier that applies to a human being. And when I say reasonable, the word reasonable under law is not what it means to normal people. Normal people think reasonable is something that is the lowest level of compliance. I would argue that PHI is an incredibly expansive concept, and it goes from what you would think it would start with, which is your name, your age, your sex, and then you move on. Social security numbers, email addresses, IP addresses, URLs, device identifiers. In other words, if you're using some kind of device to pick up the medical data, is that machine address something that is personally identifiable to you? Unique identifiers, database and otherwise. So the idea is this. If you are in the medical realm, you have to think of PHI as something that can be walked back to a human being. And so, again, think expansively. The HITECH Act augmented HIPAA in 2009. It gave it teeth, as I like to say. And it's broken down into five parts. Basically, because I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to run through them. There's a data breach requirement notification. This is a hallmark of almost all privacy laws, irrespective of the sector. Essentially, stuff breaks, i.e. the data gets out there. You have to let people know. You have to have privacy and security protocols, as I mentioned before. But I think the most important thing is it creates standing for litigants. In other words, it gives individuals the right to sue for their loss of PHI, and it imposes a variety of criminal and civil penalties. And I'm going to say the first word again, criminal. The point being is that at least the federal government and the states have their analogs as well that might be more substantive than HIPAA. They're taking it very seriously as to how this data is being used, which means that obviously anytime you're procuring or offering a cloud solution in health, you have to think about this very, very strategically. The omnibus rule was passed last year, much to the dismay, I think, of a lot of cloud solution providers. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about, well, wait a minute, can we still have this argument about whether or not we, as a solution provider, are a business associate to a covered entity? The answer, as far as I'm concerned, is no. Most cloud service providers are going to have an incredibly difficult to impossible time arguing they are not a business associate. And as Larry mentioned, there has to be, as a layer of compliance, not just the solution contract, hey, you know, provide this particular solution. So say, for example, it's software as a solution. I deal a lot with that. And it's not enough for the vendor to simply say, okay, well, here's our contract. We're done now, right? There has to be an additional agreement. It's a compliance point. That agreement is basically saying, you swear you're going to comply with HIPAA, right? Please say you're going to do that, because we need to have enforcement mechanisms to say that we imposed that risk allocation upon you. Very important point in the cloud. So getting back to FISMA, right? Switching back to the government. I hope I'm doing well on time. Switching back to the government, FISMA essentially was created to make the government grow up. And among the things that it does is it forces all of, I have 5 minutes, thank you. That's a very nice card. They have obligations essentially to create continuous monitoring. They have obligations to create a framework that can be monitored. They have obligations to do risk assessments and inventories. In other words, what do we have and where is it leaking? And then it has obligations for ownership, as I like to put it. In other words, various chief positions have to be tasked with owning aspects of this process. Now, interestingly enough, this was 2002, right? And this was well before anyone said, is it cloudy or rainy for my software? This is a time when the well really was situated in the house or on the property of the house. Point being is that it mandates a lot of things that are equally, if not more, applicable to the cloud, and that is to mitigate risk, to assess security awareness training, protocols, so on and so forth. Much easier when you're talking about the well on your own property. Interestingly enough, FISMA forged a very close relationship with the federal government and the NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Why is this important to government agencies, state as well? Because there are a great many standards and compliance manuals and procedures that NIST puts out. And essentially, NIST and FISMA are like peas and carrots. If a federal agency is deploying some kind of cloud solution, they essentially have to, at the very baseline, and we'll talk a little bit more about FedRAMP, at the very baseline, they have to comply with these standards. And they have to make sure that their vendors are complying as well. And so here is a list of some of the major publications. They're scorchers. If you're really bored one day and you want to put down 50 Shades of Grey, I recommend it. It is incredibly entertaining. Point being is that it is designed to be incredibly leverageable in a corporate environment. It reads well. They're very useful. I think for those of you who are looking for a crash course in what standards look like in the federal world, because these are essentially ISO standards that have been taken from, you know, the corporate context and sort of grafted into the non-military sector. By the way, these do not apply to military. MIL is spec'd differently. So they have MIL spec protocols that are different. We still had WikiLeaks. Figure that one out. Quickly, just to talk about the various delivery models, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to drill back down to something very basic. Those are the statutes that I think are important. There are many others. But there are essentially three major deployment strategies or deployment solutions for cloud providers, and that's essentially software as a service. As I mentioned, I deal a lot with that. So for example, I have many, many clients that are trying to create automation systems and EHR systems for hospitals. And that's software as a service. Essentially, the hospital turns on the machine, it goes over the net, and everything is rendered and processed on our client side. All the data is hosted on our client side in a distributed fashion. That's software as a service. Platform as a service is a related concept, but that could mean, for example, you as the state agency or you as the hospital might actually be using some kind of structured cloud solution to deploy your own applications or your own services or develop within that. And then there's infrastructure. That's a classic concept. It's computing power. It's storage. It's the pipes that essentially you used to take for granted as being, you know, a function of a single box or a cluster of boxes sitting somewhere in a data center. The idea, again, is, oh, well, if we distribute it, it's going to be that much cheaper and scalable, and you can pay as you go. Why is that important? Well, because I think one of the things that people forget about, particularly when it comes to G&H, is that not all cloud solutions are created equal. Obviously, you have some major players. Good. Thank you. You have some major players. Obviously, AWS is all over this today, I'm sure. Microsoft, IBM, they're major, major players. But when you're talking about smaller players as well, I think it goes across the board. You have to really think about what their contracts are saying, particularly with regard to your regulatory concerns. And when you talk to any vendor, they're essentially going to give you their standard form contract. And it's incumbent upon you, if you're the IT people, if you're the procurement people, if you're the legal, to make sure that you read it carefully, obviously. And secondly, that you negotiate it and structure it in such a way that it speaks to a lot of these issues. The business associate agreement is one way of doing that to an extent, because that's an agreement that's mandated by the government, and it has a lot of the bells and whistles that you probably would need anyway. So you have to do the due diligence in terms of what the vendor or the provider is actually offering. How long have they done it? Have they done it for health or government sectors? Do they offer indemnification? Do they offer termination privileges that allow ramp off? In other words, do they give you the opportunity to migrate and take the data off of their servers or off of their distributed networks and move it somewhere else? Because again, ownership is critical. Migration is critical in the sectors, in these sectors. It's not, I guess everyone's using the whole cat video analogy. You know, we're not talking about cat videos, right? So being able to have these mechanisms in the contract are absolutely important, which means that you have to negotiate, which means that the IT department should not be left alone, or the IT folks should not be left alone to do their job. Unfortunately, you're going to have the lawyers and the procurement people in the room at the same time to talk about these regulatory concerns and make sure that the contracts, at the very least, the paper reflects that. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but this is a very high-level concern breakdown. It's in the slide, and you know, I took great pleasure writing this. It was just as much fun as reading the NIST manuals, but it really is sort of a core concern list, right? You know, if they have a SLA, what are the penalties to deal with SLA non-conformant? What if they're dealing with, you know, if you're dealing with a company that's located in New Mexico, but your agency is located elsewhere? What about the functionality? How long does the functionality have to be in place? So on and so forth. These are common sense things, but I think having it on a single card sometimes will help you kickstart your discussion with your people. I think it's impossible to say that the government is not moving into the cloud. It's impossible to say that healthcare is not moving to the cloud. It's without a doubt the program du jour. As Larry mentioned, the White House itself put out a cloud-first policy. FedRAMP is essentially something that was developed with NIST and a variety of partners, and FedRAMP is essentially a certification program for cloud providers. The idea is if you're in government, particularly federal, it's mandated, but state, you might want to think about it as well, you want to look for FedRAMP providers or providers that are close to FedRAMP certification or on their way. One of the things that's amazing about that is that, well, I don't know if it's amazing, is that there's a third-party layer of oversight that's unique. There are three PAOs. These are essentially paid providers who go in and audit and make sure that the FedRAMP providers are doing their job on an ongoing basis, and they help structure the certification for the FedRAMP provider. The idea being is that you should not be shopping for off-the-shelf cloud solutions that are essentially just for anybody or for public, excuse me, non-public constituencies. And think of regulatory not as a barrier. I know that sounds ridiculous, but both the government and the healthcare industries are moving rapidly into the cloud. It's going to be a bumpy ride for those of you who are being initiated into this. But there are enablers, and it should not be seen as an impediment. That's my last spiel on this. Quickly, laws that are changing. FISMA is allegedly supposedly to be updated. It was actually voted unanimously by the House. Imagine that. And so it's pending approval by the Senate. We'll see if that gets anywhere. And I think HIPAA, to the extent that HIPAA has been augmented significantly, is going to become the baseline for a variety of private and public litigation actions against non-complying parties. So keep that in mind. It has teeth, and people are going to start biting. I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for coming.
So please hold your questions for Kaiser till lunch. Let me bring up the panel, and we'll get back on track. Young, Marlin, Tom, you know who you are. So we'll put Young here, then Brett, and then Mark, and then Marlin, number three, or four, and then Tom at the end. So and James, I'm sorry, I forgot James. Where's Young? Have us welcome. Good to see you again. All right. Do we have enough seats?
One, two, three, four, five. We need one more. Hold from front row.
We'll share mics a little bit. You can sit down. All right. Let's start with welcome, everybody. We'll start with Young. And just please tell us about your little organization, your little startup company, and how its work is relevant to our topic here about the outstanding obstacles and issues we still have to overcome.
Hello, everyone, and very pleased to be here. This is like third or fourth time. And so I work for a company called Microsoft. I know if you have heard about it. Now, get to the point. When we talk about cloud computing, either verticals or just general public, there's a couple obstacles, or I should say challenge, because they are solvable. I just kind of highlight three I see very significant. Certainly security is one, and Microsoft has done recently is to default to device encryption. So if you are deployed Windows 8 in a management environment, it's default to encrypt the entire device, the hard disk. So that's a default. So that's something